We talked about signaling in neurons already. That's electrochemical signaling. And this next chapter is about just purely chemical signaling. The reason that neuronal signaling is electrochemical is because it involves ionic current. In other words, the flow of ions. And ions carry charge. And that ionic current is mostly through the membrane of the excitable cell, changing the membrane potential. But as we saw in propagation of action potentials down the length of the axon, ionic current also involves flow of ions within the cell from one part to the next, which is why nodes of Ranvier happen to work the way they do, right? Why do we call it propagation of action potentials, by the way? What does that mean? That's what happens, but what does the word mean? When we talk about propagation of the species, for instance, what are we talking about? Creating new ones, right? And that's why that word is used. It's not one action potential that travels. Each action potential creates a new action potential next to it. That's why it's called that. Well, anyway, that's electrochemical. It's chemical because there are chemicals being moved around, but it's electrochemical because they're carrying charge. For chemical signals, it's just the presence of the chemical that matters. And these chemicals aren't necessarily moving through membranes. In fact, usually they're not moving through membranes. Chemical signals operate as ligands, and they therefore bind to something, right? That something that they bind to are receptors. And macromolecularly speaking, what are receptors? Proteins of some sort. Well, proteins are ideally suited to being receptors for signals because proteins can have just about any shape you can want, right? Because of their pretty much unlimited number of ways in which you can combine amino acids. But in a lot of cases, proteins also operate as the signals. So you'll have a signal that is one protein binding to another protein operating as a receptor, and then that is what ultimately will cause a response. In this first slide, we can see that chemical signals, which is the broad category, can operate, these are functional distinctions here, not chemical distinctions. They can operate as either hormones or as local mediators. Now, a hormone is a chemical signal that gets broadcast throughout the body. And therefore, just about all cells of the body receive that signal. The reason that just about all cells receive that signal, the reason that it's broadcast, is because hormones make their way into the bloodstream. And blood travels everywhere in the body, except to some places with dead cells, like the epidermis. Dead cells wouldn't respond to signals anyway. Now, I say that nearly all cells receive these hormones as signals, but that does not mean that anything happens because of the general fact that any chemical signal will have an effect only if there is a binding of that signal to a receptor. And the reason that some cells respond to hormones, whereas some don't, even though both cells are exposed to that hormone, is that some cells will have the proper receptor for that hormone, others will not. No receptor means that the cell doesn't realize, in a sense, that the hormone is even there. But local mediators, even though they might be exactly the same chemicals, because this is not a chemical distinction, it's a functional distinction, how they operate, they're different from hormones in that they do not get broadcast throughout the body. They operate locally. They're released by whatever cell produces them, and they're released into the interstitium, the interstitial fluid between the cells, where they'll diffuse some short distance and if they encounter a receptor, which they do nearby, then a nearby cell will be affected by that signal. But the rest of the body doesn't even have a chance of reacting to it because it doesn't make its way through the bloodstream. Notice that this orange cell is the cell that is making this local mediator. Well, some of these little signal molecules, the purple spheres, are diffusing to nearby other cells, the purple cells, and having an effect. In that case, that local mediator would be classified as a paracrine signal, because it's released by one cell and it affects a nearby cell of a different type. Notice that some of those, though, are actually affecting the same cell that produced them. And so those local mediators that are released by a cell and affect the same cell or same cell type are called autocrine signals. Auto meaning self, right? Para meaning next to. Well, hormones being broadcast throughout the body are classified as endocrine signals. All right. Those are functional distinctions, though. The same exact chemical could be a neurotransmitter or a hormone or a paracrine signal, depending on how it's being used. Let's go to slide two and look at the general scheme of things for how chemical signals operate. Like I said, nothing is going to happen unless you have a binding event between the chemical signal and its specific sort of receptor. Now, a single chemical signal can have multiple different receptors for that signal, some of which can occur on one cell, some of which occur on another cell. And this is one reason of several why the same exact hormone can have different effects in different tissues. Because if they bind to different kinds of receptors in different kinds of tissues, different things happen thereafter in those cells. Hormones' jobs are done, or a chemical signal in general, its job is done when it binds to the receptor. What happens after that depends on the specific case. Depends on what type of receptor it is, depends on what type of cell that's occurring in, what kind of things are in the cell. But the things that happen in response to the binding of the hormone to the receptor, or the signal to the receptor, will not happen unless there is that binding event. It's just the first occurrence in a chain of events that occurs. And that chain of events that gets invoked by the binding of the signal to the receptor is called signal transduction. The signal is being transduced by being received and then creating a new signal, basically. It's kind of like someone handing a note to someone else. After that note gets handed off, the first delivery boy, or delivery person, let's say, its job is done, right? The difference here is that the reason this is not a perfect analogy is that in signal transduction, you're really changing the message into something else, but it gets delivered to something, and it gets changed along the way. The message itself is really just different chemicals that get activated or created in response to the original signal arriving at the receptor. So, and there can be many steps involved or not that many, it just depends. But that's what signal transduction is. The second messengers that are listed here, or that are shown here, is shown here as a phrase, that just refers to the second, third, fourth, or however many are created in this chain of events. They're all collectively called second messengers, because they don't actually get activated unless you have the first messenger, which is the original signal binding to the receptor. Well, in response to the signal transduction mechanism, and there are different kinds, there are some sort of cellular responses. And so metabolism, generally speaking, gets affected somehow. Something gets made that wouldn't get made, something gets signaled for destruction, whatever. So a change is going to occur in the cell. Enzymes get activated or deactivated. Those sorts of things are listed here as cellular responses. But also in response to some signals, genes get turned on or off. And that's why you also have in the nucleus number 4 being listed as changes in gene expression. All right, so when you have changes in gene expression, assuming those are protein-coding genes, which usually they are, that means in the ultimate effect of those types of signals is that the cell is going to create more of a certain protein or stop creating that protein, turning genes on or off. On the bottom of the figure, we can see that a single signal, one hormone for instance, can invoke multiple different responses within the same cell. So there's a divergence of information here. One signal is being received, but that's causing two different things to happen at the same time. Two signal transduction cascades or pathways to be invoked. And what is it that the... Well, I'll get into that a little bit later. So that's a divergence of information, though, right? A splitting apart. In the second example, and these are just cartoon examples, two different signals can actually cause the same thing to happen in the cell. In fact, they can cooperate in causing that same thing to happen. That's a convergence of information, right? Coming together rather than a divergence. And it can be even more complicated than that. Different signals being received by the same cell can actually create their own intermediate effect, which then interacts with each other in two different pathways. Well, in the third slide, we're looking at a graph that's very similar to one we looked at before when we were talking about enzyme kinetics. Seems like a long time ago, probably. But remember, we talked about K sub M, which was the Michaelis-Menten constant. Remember all of this? Does anyone remember this? You remember hearing about it, okay. Well, do you remember what Km is? I mean, it's a constant. It has a value, but what actually is it? What are the units of it? What did you say? Not an enzyme concentration, no, but a concentration of something. Of what? Substrate. Km, remember, was the specific concentration of substrate that would cause the enzyme to operate at exactly one half of its maximum value. Remember that? Well, there's a very similar thing here that we're looking at. Notice that this is 50% of 100, so halfway to maximum. But the graph is percent receptors bound by the hormone versus hormone concentration. All right? The receptors are proteins on the surface of the cell. There's only so many of them, of course. And since there are only so many receptors, just like for carrier proteins or channel proteins, they can be saturated. They can be all busy at once, in which case they're saturated, right? That's what maximum here represents. The reason this plateaus out is because if you have so many hormone molecules present that every one of the receptors is already bound to a hormone, it doesn't do any good to add more hormone, right? Once again, it's like the turnstile analogy. Having a bigger crowd wanting to get in does not make people get in any faster once all the turnstiles are operating. So anything involving membrane-bound proteins is a saturable mechanism, whether it's carrier proteins, channel proteins, or in this case, receptor proteins for hormones. That explains the leveling off. But completely analogous to KM for enzyme kinetics, you have KD, which is the hormone concentration, the value of the hormone concentration at which exactly half of those receptors are bound to hormone at the moment. And that's a particularly steep part of this curve. So having not very much of an increase or not very much of a decrease in hormone concentration can have a drastic effect on the cell because it has a drastic effect in how many of the receptors are receiving that signal and therefore causing a result to happen. Does that all make sense? Okay. Oh, by the way, notice the hormone concentrations here had units of nanomolar. Nanomolar is not that much. It's not a very high concentration, right? Nano is a tiny prefix. And that makes the good point that hormones are very potent signals because you don't need very many of them at all to have a big effect in cells. And as we go to slide 4, we can see why this is true. And this is true particularly for hormones that are hydrophilic. Hydrophilic hormones are most of your hormones, by the way. There are some hydrophobic hormones. The steroid hormones are hydrophobic. But most of your hormones are hydrophilic. And hydrophilic hormones, because they are hydrophilic, can't pass through the membrane, or can't pass through the phospholipid bilayer of the membrane, right? And they, therefore, have their receptors located on the plasma membrane, facing exteriorly. And they don't enter the cell. They knock on the door, in a sense, by binding to a receptor that's facing the exterior of the cell. That's how most of your hormones operate. And they are very potent in terms of how many molecules it takes to have a big effect because of what we're seeing in slide 4, which is an amplification cascade. An amplification cascade is a way for the signal, or it's a way for the effect to be greatly amplified compared to how much signal there was originally. It's a cascade because it happens in steps, like a waterfall, which is what a cascade is, right? So this signal transduction that we were talking about in the earlier slide, that's what all these arrows collectively represent. This is a signal transduction pathway, but it's operating in an amplification cascade. And the reason that it's amplification is because, just for simplicity, we're putting easy to use numbers beside it. So there's just one molecule of hormone originally here. All right? Each of those that one molecule is going to bind to a receptor, right? If it does anything, it's going to bind to a receptor. And so for that one molecule that binds to that one receptor, it's going to activate several different G proteins, which is the next step in this particular pathway. It's not always going to be G proteins, but this is just an example. And so one, and that's already amplification because you have one molecule causing the creation of several molecules that are now acting as signals. And for each one of those, several different messengers are created in response to that. And so there's amplification at each step. And if you look at the side, you can see that in response to one original molecule, you have 100 million molecules created as a result. And by the way, it's never the case that you have a single hormone molecule. You would actually have many. So you would multiply that 100 million by several times. That's a hell of a big amplification, which is why nanomolar concentrations of hormones are potent still because of the amplification. By the way, this is also why you have such a complexity. You might think, well, why not just have the hormone directly cause what the cell is trying to do? The more steps you have, the more opportunity you have for amplification. And therefore, you can have a very big effect without requiring the endocrine cells that are responsible for producing the hormones to produce so many hormones. They can produce tiny amounts, broadcast them out throughout the body in nanomolar concentrations, and still have huge effects in the types of tissues that have the receptors for those hormones. Now, in 5, we're looking at major ways in which hormones operate. And the first 3 of these 4 that are shown here are hydrophilic hormones. Like I said, those are the majority of your hormones. Things like insulin, for instance, antidiuretic hormone, those are hydrophilic hormones. They do not enter the cell because of their hydrophilic nature. And so they operate as ligands that bind to membrane-bound receptor proteins. See that in all 3 of these first ones. That's always going to be the case for a hydrophilic hormone. It's always going to bind to a membrane-bound receptor. But there are different kinds of receptors involved, of course, and these are some major classes. So there are ligand-gated ion channels. Now, ligand, I keep using the word hormone, which is usually what we're talking about, but actually any hydrophilic signal, whether it's operating as a hormone or not, can do any of these things. For instance, neurotransmitters are signals as well, right? They're chemical signals, but they're not hormones because they're not released into the bloodstream. They're operating locally. Well, neurotransmitters don't enter cells. They operate as ligands and will bind, after they're being released from the neuron, will bind as that ligand to a ligand-gated ion channel. This is exactly what's happening at your neuromuscular junctions, which are the synapses between a motor neuron that you fire in order to tell a skeletal muscle to contract and the skeletal muscle that it's connected to. The neurotransmitter gets released from the neuron. It binds to the ligand-gated ion channel, which in the case of your neuromuscular junction is a sodium ion channel. That causes sodium to come into that muscle cell, which causes the local depolarization. That brings it up to threshold, and then the voltage-gated ion channels take over and you have an action potential. That's how your muscles contract. So that's a response to a hydrophilic signal. Another way is for there to be a G protein involved. And so there are so-called G protein coupled receptor molecules. And we'll talk about G proteins in a minute. But G proteins cause various things to happen, including some examples that we'll look at. Including involving cyclic AMP and something called IP3, which we'll get to. But those are 2 different alternative responses to a G-protein-coupled hormone. What makes G-proteins operate for other things besides cyclic AMP and IP3, but those are the biggies. Anyway, we'll look at examples of G-protein-coupled receptors in a minute. There are also what are called receptor kinases, including receptor tyrosine kinases, which we'll look at an example of. But what, in general, are kinases? Yeah, they are enzymes that phosphorylate other things. And so receptor kinases are doing double duty. They are a receptor. That's why receptor is in the name of them. But in response to them receiving the ligand, the signal that they're specific for, they become activated as an enzyme themselves, a kinase, and therefore they phosphorylate other things, like still other enzymes. Enzymes can get turned on by being phosphorylated, so a receptor kinase can actually work as an enzyme to turn on another enzyme inside the cell, causing something to happen that wouldn't happen if you didn't have that signal there originally. Okay, we'll look at examples of those in a little bit, but the fourth one is different because this one involves a hydrophobic signal, like your steroid hormones, like cortisol or testosterone or estrogen. These, all the things that come from cholesterol originally, are your steroid hormones, and they, because they are lipids, they are hydrophobic. And hydrophobic particles don't mind being around those tails of the phospholipid bilayer, right? So they can slip right through membrane. Not only plasma membrane, but they can actually go through the nuclear envelope as well. So for hydrophobic signals, the receptors for them are found inside cells, and in some types, sometimes even inside the nucleus, because the membrane is not a barrier for them. So they don't have to knock on the door. They actually go into the target cell, and that's where they bind to the receptor that it's specific for that hormone, assuming that the receptor exists in that type of cell. If it doesn't, then that type of cell just won't respond to that hydrophobic hormone. But not only is that a fundamental difference compared to hydrophilic signals, but there's usually not nearly as many steps of transduction for a hydrophobic signal as there is for a hydrophilic signal, and therefore not nearly as much amplification. In fact, it's basically a much more direct process, like you see in the cartoon here. This steroid hormone, we'll say, the hydrophobic signal, the orange ball, comes in and binds to its receptor, and that actually directly then binds to DNA, turning on transcription. And that is, by the way, the general result of hydrophobic signals. Hydrophilic signals can cause all kinds of things to happen in the cytosol mostly. Hydrophobic signals, in general, will have their effect realized by adjusting gene expression. Okay, the regulation of gene expression is usually the ultimate effect of hydrophobic signals. Genes get turned on or off, in other words. Oh, and before I leave that, let me just say that's also the major reason why the ultimate effect of a hydrophilic signal is much faster than the ultimate effect of a hydrophobic signal. Because hydrophilic signals usually operate simply by activating or deactivating things that are already in the cell. And so it's a very quick effect. You just have to throw switches, basically. You don't have to create the things. But for a hydrophobic signal, you're telling the cell, okay, build some new proteins, which is a much more involved process. It takes a lot longer for that to happen. And so it's not an immediate effect. Steroid hormones, you know, you might not have, if you take them exogenously as a prescription, you might not actually realize the effects for days rather than immediately. Okay, let's go to 6 now and talk about a G protein and how it operates in conjunction with a receptor that it's associated with. A G protein is actually multiple polypeptides, first of all. Notice that there is an alpha, a beta, and a gamma subunit, all in green, but the overall combination of those three is called a G protein. And notice that the alpha subunit, which is one of the three polypeptides, while it's in its idle state, not working as a signal, at rest in a sense, is associated with a GDP. It's bound to a GDP. What is GDP? Guanosine diphosphate. Yeah, guanine is the nitrogenous base. Guanosine is the actual nucleoside, and then when you add a phosphate, it becomes the nucleotide, which we call guanosine diphosphate. In this case, two phosphates. Anyway, notice that it is hanging out on the inner surface of the plasma membrane. And remember, the plasma membrane is a fluid mosaic, so it's not stuck in one position. It can move around, but it's always on that inner surface. And also, the receptor itself, the purple receptor molecule, it's also shuffling around in there. It's part of the mosaic. Well, there can be an association between the G protein and the receptor, but there isn't going to be unless the receptor has the right shape. And the receptor isn't going to have the right shape unless it is actually bound to the signal molecule, which you see happening in part two. The signal is the ligand, right? Whether that's a hormone, whatever. It's a signal molecule that has found a receptor that has the right shape for it, and therefore it binds. And the general case of the binding of a ligand to a protein is that that protein is going to undergo conformational change, right? Well, this is why knocking on the door works. It's not just knocking on the door, it's actually changing the shape of the door by binding to it, right? And so hopefully it makes sense to you that a receptor for a hydrophilic signal not only has to be membrane bound so that it can face outward, it has to be transmembrane as well. Does that make sense? If it were a peripheral protein just on the exterior monolayer, yes, the signal could bind to it and it could change shape, but the inside of the cell would never know about that. It's just something that's happening on that outer surface. Only if it's transmembrane will the shape change actually affect something that's inside the cell, because the inside part of that protein will change shape as well. That's part of the signal transduction. That's why it is transduced, I should say. All right, so that has happened once the ligand binds. Now the purple thing, the receptor, is in the right shape to be able to interact with the G protein that happens by. And when that happens, this allows for a GTP molecule that's just part of the pool of molecules in the cytosol to come by and displace the GDP that was there. So it's not that GDP is turning into GTP. GTP that's already been produced by the cell is coming along and knocking off the GDP and taking its place. That is what activates the G protein. So we now say that this is an activated G protein. And when that happens, notice that the trimeric structure of this G protein gets disrupted. And the alpha subunit that used to be associated with beta and gamma is now on its own. All right? So you have a alpha subunit with a GTP stuck to it. That's an activated signal at this point. And what happens from here on can be any of several different things, depending on the cell that it's in. But this is how G protein coupled receptors work in general. This is the first set of steps. So this is kind of a generalized case of what happens next. This activated G protein is now able to interact with other things that it wouldn't interact with unless it's activated. And notice in this case, what it's doing is interacting with this other purple protein in the membrane. And that interaction, of course, is going to change that protein and therefore allow it to work in a way that it didn't before. So that's what I'm saying is the variable part. It could be just about anything that happens in response to that activation of the G protein. But that G protein, while it's in its activated state, while it's carrying that GTP around and is on its own, can interact with several different things, several different copies of the same one. This is part of the amplification, right? One G protein got activated, but while it's still activated, it can activate several second messengers after that. And so this is kind of analogous to a messenger RNA molecule, right? You make one messenger RNA. Well, from that, you can make several different copies of the polypeptide as long as the messenger RNA still exists. Similarly, as long as the G protein is still activated, it can continue to activate second messengers beyond it, multiple ones. But it's only going to be activated for so long, because eventually the alpha subunit itself will deactivate itself, because it has autocatalytic activity. It has GTPase activity, so it operates as an enzyme. And it will cleave off a phosphate of that GTP, turning it into GDP. And that inactivates it. Once it has a GDP stuck to it instead of a GTP, that changes the shape, and that allows for the alpha, beta, and gamma to come back together, and you're back to the beginning. It's a G protein that is now inactive but can be activated again. So there are all kinds of different G protein signal transduction mechanisms operating in cells, and it's an active area of research. In this case, we're looking at a specific example of how this could operate. Oh, we're on slide 7. So the G protein coupled receptor in this specific example is the purple thing that is specific for acetylcholine. Acetylcholine is a hydrophilic signal. This happens to be the signal that is released as a neurotransmitter from motor neurons that innervate skeletal muscles at the neuromuscular junction I was talking about. So when you decide to flex your elbow, which means to contract your biceps brachii, what you're doing is causing an action potential in a motor neuron that gets propagated down to the terminal to release acetylcholine. The acetylcholine here binds to a receptor. Well, this actually isn't the one specifically in the neuromuscular junction. I'm just saying acetylcholine that's the same stuff. In this case, though, the ligand binding to the receptor activates a G protein. And the G protein, once it's activated, like I said, that's the alpha with a GTP by itself, wanders around in the fluid mosaic until it encounters this ion channel in pink. Well, this ion channel is normally closed. And while it's closed, it might as well not be there in terms of the flow of ions. There's no flow of ions through it, right? But all of a sudden, the activated G protein, by interacting with the ion channel, will open it up. And this is why it's a quick response to this kind of signal. You don't have to build the channel and embed it in the membrane. It's already there. You just need to switch it to a different configuration. And that's immediate. So all of a sudden, in response to this acetylcholine, you now can have the flow of, in this case, potassium ions through the channels. Notice that the two red arrows indicate potassium flowing in both directions. Well, that actually does occur, but it's not going to be equal flow, right? There's going to be flow in one direction much more than the other because there's a gradient in place. Why is there a gradient in place? Because you'll continuously have sodium-potassium exchange pumps operating. So which way is most of the flow of potassium going to be? Out of the cell, right? If this were an excitable cell that we're looking at here, what would that outward flow of potassium cause? It would cause what? It would make it more negative. And what would we call that? Hyperpolarization. Because they're both negatives. Repolarization is getting negative after an action potential is peaked out. Here we're not talking about an action potential happening. It's at rest already. And it's making it even more negative. That's hyperpolarization. So this acetylcholine would cause this excitable cell to be less likely to make an action potential of its own for this reason. But the important thing in terms of this chapter is that it's operating via a G protein coupled receptor. All right, another example of things that use G protein coupled receptors is shown in 8. We'll look at the involvement of the G protein in this in a second, but first let's look at the major player in the game here, which is cyclic AMP. And we've already talked about this as an important signal. It's used for various reasons as well. So it's a versatile signal, just like a G protein is. But we can see here why it's called cyclic AMP rather than just AMP. It all starts out as ATP, which you're familiar with, right? So this is adenosine. Adenine plus the blue thing makes up adenosine. What's the blue thing? Well, what is it specifically?
Ribose.
Right, so this is an RNA nucleotide, right? Because of this oxygen. If you didn't have this oxygen, it would be deoxyribose, right? But it's adenine and ribose make up adenosine. You have three phosphates, so it's adenosine triphosphate. That, under the right conditions, meaning if you have the right enzyme activated, can be converted into cyclic AMP, which is called that because instead of just having one connection point with the phosphate, between the phosphate and the sugar, which is at the 5 prime normally, you now have an additional one, the 5 prime connection plus a connection back to the 3 prime. And so that forms a cycle or a circle. That's why it's cyclic AMP. Normal run-of-the-mill AMP, as you see on the bottom, just has the one connection point and just one phosphate. Well, I said you have to have the right enzyme to make that happen, and that right enzyme is adenylyl cyclase. Adenylyl cyclase is the enzyme that catalyzes the conversion of ATP into cyclic AMP. And cyclic AMP then operates as an active signal for as long as it exists. But just like a G protein is not going to be indefinitely activated, neither is cyclic AMP. So eventually cyclic AMP will be changed into run-of-the-mill AMP, involving still another enzyme, which is phosphodiesterase. Okay? So that's basically what the structure of cyclic AMP is and why it's called that. Now we can look in slide 9 at how it operates as part of a G protein coupled response. So we have a ligand molecule in orange labeled L. Whatever that is, it's a hydrophilic signal, and it is binding to its specific receptor in purple on the surface of the cell. That invokes a G protein, causing what I've already told you happened. Alpha subunit dissociates from beta and gamma as a GTP displaces GDP on that alpha. Right? Now it's an activated G protein, and in this case, the activated alpha finds a nearby membrane-bound enzyme in blue, which happens to be adenylyl cyclase, the enzyme that I said is responsible for converting ATP into cyclic AMP. So once it's activated by the G protein interacting with adenylyl cyclase will do that job. ATP is getting turned into cyclic AMP. Cyclic AMP is, like I said, a versatile signal, so that can cause all sorts of different things to happen in different cells, but this is how it gets produced to begin with. All right. Now, I said that it's only going to remain as cyclic AMP for so long, which is why eventually phosphodiesterase is going to convert that into run-of-the-mill AMP, which is, you know, just going to be part of this overall ATP, ADP, AMP pool that's in a cell. So the next moment, it might get turned into an ATP for energetic reasons to be used to drive some endergonic process. It's not that AMP is saved just for the purpose of being a signal or not. It's all the same AMP once it's AMP. All right, so now assuming that phosphodiesterase does its job, that particular cyclic AMP is no longer operating as a signal. And by then, it might be also true that there's no more signal originally, the ligand, being released from whatever cell produced it. So it's sparse now and therefore not bound to the receptor, and therefore it's not activating any more G proteins. They've come back together and everything is turned off at this point. But it can be turned back on quickly because you don't have to build all this stuff. You just have to switch it into a different configuration. In 10, we're looking at a table that lists just some of the things that are regulated by cyclic AMP. Notice that several of them respond to epinephrine, which is a fight-or-flight hormone released from the adrenal glands. And this causes various things to happen in different parts of the body, but they are totally different things that are happening in response to the same signal. Muscle and liver, it tells to degrade glycogen. And when you're in fight or flight, you want your brain to stay alive. The brain uses almost nothing but glucose as its energy source. So stress hormones, which includes epinephrine, spare the glucose. They save it for the brain and cause the rest of the body to use other sources of energy. So to have enough glucose for the brain, it tells the liver and the muscle to break down glycogen, which is stored glucose, right, as a polypeptide, so they can use that glucose, saving the one that's in the stuff that's in the blood for the brain. But that's a totally different effect than the same exact epinephrine molecule has on the heart, for instance, where it tells it to start pumping harder and faster because you're probably going to be either fighting or running if you want to save your life. And that requires a lot more muscular activity and therefore a lot more oxygen being delivered to those muscles, therefore a lot more heart work. So totally different responses to the same exact signal simply because that original knocking on the door causes different things to happen inside the cell because of different things that are occurring in those cells. All right, 11. Now, we're looking at protein kinase A here, which is also an important and versatile signal as part of signal transduction cascade. Cyclic AMP is part of signal transduction cascade. Well, so is protein kinase A. And just like cyclic AMP, it's used for various different reasons in different cells. But it is a kinase, obviously, and therefore it operates, like as all kinases do, to phosphorylate other things. And phosphorylation is a mechanism used over and over in cells to either activate or deactivate things. A lot of times they're enzymes. So you can turn an enzyme on or off quickly by either phosphorylating or dephosphorylating it. You shouldn't think of phosphorylation meaning that always it's going to turn something on and dephosphorylation always turns it off. It depends on the specific situation. But because that enzyme already exists, doesn't have to be built, phosphorylating it and dephosphorylating it can quickly activate or deactivate it. Well, protein kinase A obviously is a kinase that phosphorylates proteins. That's why protein is in its name. It itself is a protein, but the reason it's called a protein kinase is because the things that it phosphorylates are other proteins. All right, and there are several protein kinases. This is one of the main ones. It's protein kinase A is its name. We can see, though, that it is a multimeric protein. It consists of four polypeptide subunits. The two orange and the two green all together make up one protein kinase A. But the two orange subunits are regulatory, whereas the two green ones are the catalytic subunits, meaning that those are the ones with active sites that actually can operate as an enzyme. The regulatory subunits, though, determine whether or not the catalytic subunits work. And in the off configuration, when protein kinase A is inactivated, all four of these subunits are together. And it's actually the binding of the regulatory subunits to the catalytic subunits that keeps them from being catalytic. All right. When it's all together, they don't work as enzymes. Well, what is it that actually causes dissociation? It's cyclic AMP. If cyclic AMP is present, it is able to bind to regulatory active sites, which are just receptor sites on these regulatory subunits of the protein. And that, of course, changes their shape. When you change the shape of the regulatory subunits, it no longer fits well with the catalytic subunits, so the whole thing dissociates. And when catalytic subunits are on their own, which happens in the presence of cyclic AMP, now all of a sudden they're able to operate as enzymes, and specifically as an enzyme that will cause a phosphate group to be stuck onto some other protein. but only when they're on their own. And if cyclic AMP gets destroyed, as it will eventually by phosphodiesterase, it will eventually be at such a low concentration that it will diffuse away from these regulatory subunits, dissociate from the regulatory subunits, in other words, which will cause the regulatory subunits to come back together with the catalytic subunits, and that turns protein kinase A off. And therefore, whatever the phosphorylation of that other protein does that kinase is responsible for will not happen. Okay, I'll have to stop there.